questions tam mi sangsai mi kam kam tam tam le.
There seems to be in Western societies more of an emphasis on passion. So does passion create suffering?
You mean in Western society, passion is seen as a good thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. well, the word passion can refer to different things, just like desire, the English word desire. And it's helpful to understand that in Buddha Dhamma, there are two kinds of desire, or two kinds of passion, if you like. One is tanha, which is the quality that the Buddha named as being the direct cause of suffering. So the best English word to translate tanha is craving. So craving has got for those of you who are familiar with English, it's got a kind of agitated and obsessive and self-centered quality to it. So tanha, almost without exception, whenever the word tanha is used in the Pali canon, I only know one place where it's used to have a wholesome meaning. Everywhere else, it's a cause of suffering, the main cause of dukkha. So the other kind of desire is chanda. Chanda, and in English letters you write that chanda, chanda. So chanda is absolutely necessary for enlightenment. So the word chanda can be translated into English as interest, enthusiasm, zeal, Z-E-A-L, zeal, or desire. And I'm not sure in Thai language how you'd translate chanda.
We usually translate love of learning.
Love of learning.
Chanda.
Interesting. Because in the Buddha's teaching, there is a set of four qualities called the Iddhipada. Iddhi, it can mean psychic power, or it can just mean success. So the Iddhipada is the four bases of success. So you've succeeded in coming to Puchaisai. So those four bases of success are you had to be interested to come. You needed chanda. So then you also needed virya. You needed to act on that interest. Okay, fill in the form on the website. Make contact with the organizers. Chitta, you had to think about what else have I got to do? Do I have to make any other arrangements? Where should I book my ticket? So those three, chanda, virya, and chitta. So interest, energy, and reflection. So think to be interested in doing something, to put energy into doing something, and then to think about how you're going to do it. So those three work together. So with those three, then the fourth of the Iddhipada is called vimamsa, and that's reviewing. Okay, did I get here? Yes. So those four are necessary both for practical things like coming to sit on a meditation retreat, also. They can be, used to describe spiritual development. So you have to be interested to train your mind. You have to apply energy. You have to think about how you're going to do it. And then the fourth one, which is vimamsa, is, okay, how's it going? Is the effort that I've been making, is that bringing more peace of mind? Is that bringing more clarity? So those four, they are, what in English you would call a prerequisite condition. Any kind of work, whether it's wholesome or unwholesome or neutral. So if you want to cook a meal, or you want to rob a bank, or you want to be enlightened, you need those four. So not that I'm encouraging people to rob banks, but that so that it might seem to be contradictory, but you need that kind of desire to end the desire of tanha. And so that it's a kind of desire, a kind of passion or interest that's necessary. So in the West, though, it's a very doing kind of society, particularly the USA. It's like, get out and make your own world. You get up and do it, and make it happen. Us Europeans tend to be a bit more kind of, oh, well, might been right. But generally, Westerners are very focused on doing and achieving. And so that quality of passion is often that sense of interest or enthusiasm. Yeah, we can do it. I'm going to make it happen. I'm going to really work hard and make this work. So that can be a skillful thing. Of course, it can drift into being about duoton, and it can become a cause of a lot of suffering. But in itself, that's, say, a very helpful, a necessary quality, not just helpful, but necessary. The word passion in English is also, it can be used not just in terms of referring to chanda, but also a kind of something which is a bit more unwholesome, a kind of recklessness, like to being really excited, really, say, mai samruam. You're kind of letting go of all of your boundaries. So people, they love to be going to scary movies or going to get drunk and go dancing to kind of let all their inhibitions go. And that kind of passion is, more in the tanha end of the spectrum than the chanda. But that's also something that is praised in Western society. So one of Lumpur Sumato's favorite poets is an English poet called Swinburne. And when he was a young man, Swinburne was extremely reckless, had a very kind of wild lifestyle, lots of drugs and drink, and kind of, he was a party animal. And he wrote great poetry. But then, as some would think, he was famous for this kind of very colorful, powerful poetry. But then, when he was in his 30s, I think, then some of his friends did an intervention. They had them even in Victorian England, and they kind of persuaded him to look long, to kind of calm down and not to live such a crazy life. And so he managed to get off the drink and drugs and had a more stable lifestyle, but the poems kind of dried up. So as one of his friends said, we saved the man, but we killed the poet. So then people debate about, well, which is better? Great poetry and unskillful behavior, or skillfulness and goodness, wholesomeness, and not much good poetry. But I don't think it's a black and white issue myself. But sometimes those kind of standards get used. People say, you know, you need to be passionate, you need to be excited, you need to be ready to break free of everything to create something good. But I tried that myself from when I was about 14 to 20, 21, and the result was more kind of depression and confusion and insecurity and alcoholism. and a few kind of very interesting nights, but there was no real freedom, no genuine happiness, and so that the kind of passion that you have in Buddha Dhamma, which is the passion for enlightenment, that chanda, like the Buddha sitting down under the Bodhi tree and saying, I'm not going to move from this spot, my blood can dry up, my bones can turn to dust, but I will not move from here until full enlightenment is reached. So that's passion. There's a fire there, but it's directed towards what is wholesome, but also what is genuinely liberating. So that's my perspective on that. So I would say certain kinds of passion are very useful. But it's up to each one, each individual, to reflect. And I remember there was actually a woman here in Thailand who was quite a well-known journalist, and she did an interview with me once. So she was famous for being kind of anti-establishment and kind of ready to ask monks difficult questions. So we had an interesting interview. And she said, "I don't want to stop being angry. When I'm angry, my writing is really good. If I'm peaceful, no one wants to publish me. My editor's not happy if I'm peaceful and quiet. You know, I need to be angry." And so it was that same kind of discussion that we had to say, "Well, okay, that's to do with your livelihood." But what's really valuable, what's most meaningful and helpful for you and your readers? What is it that you've got to say in your writing that is so valuable? If it's coming from a place of anger and restlessness, what's the substance of that? But I know Ajahn Chah used to be a journalist before he was a monk, so maybe he has some comments. I won't tell you the name of the journalist. It wasn't him, it was a woman. Do you have any thoughts to offer on passion and creativity or such like?
Pasatai, na krab.
Pasatai.
คือคำถามถามเรื่องความอยากที่ใช้ passion ว่ามันมีความหมายที่ดีหรือเปล่าท่านอาจารย์อธิบายโดยการแยกแยะให้เห็นว่าความอยากนั้นมันมีสองด้านในทางพุทธศาสนาคือถ้าเราเข้าใจความอยากในสองด้านนี้ชัดเจนก็จะเห็นมุมมองที่ละเอียดขึ้นนั่นคือตัณหาแล้วก็ฉันทะนะฉันทะนี่ปรากฏอยู่ในข้อธรรมที่นำไปสู่ความสำเร็จที่เรียกว่าอิทธิบาท4มันจริงๆฉันทานี่เป็นปัจจัยสำคัญเลยในการที่จะทำให้ประสบความสำเร็จในสิ่งต่างๆอย่างท่านอาจารย์ก็ยกตัวอย่างว่าแม้กระทั่งตอนที่พุทธองค์ท่านประทับอยู่ในคืนที่จะตรัสรู้อธิษฐานว่าแม้เลือดกระดูกจะแห้งไปก็ตามทีก็จะไม่ลุกจนกว่าจะบรรลุธรรมอันนี้ก็เป็นอาการปรากฏของสิ่งที่เรียกว่า passion เหมือนกันคือเป็นฉันทะฉันทานี่จะมุ่งเน้นไปสู่สิ่งที่อยากจะให้เป็นสิ่งที่ดีงามคือคนที่มีฉันทะเนี่ยจริงๆถ้าเข้าใจเรื่องฉันทะนะอย่างลึกซึ้งจริงๆเนี่ยนะการศึกษานะหรือการทำงานต่างๆในสังคมไทยเราจะสามารถเรียนรู้ได้อย่างมีความสุขและทำงานอย่างมีความสุขได้มากขึ้นอย่างทำงานอย่างมีฉันทะนี่คือเรามุ่งหวังไปที่ตัวกระบวนการของการทำงานอยากให้งานนั้นออกมาอย่างดีที่สุดนะเท่าที่จะทำได้มีความยินดีพอใจกับการทำนะแต่ไม่เกี่ยวข้องกับผลตอบแทนนะแต่ถ้าตัณหาคือมันอยากได้อยากมีอยากเป็นอยากจะได้อะไรจากการทำงานนั้นนะแต่ถ้าเป็นฉันทะคือได้ทำงานตรงนั้นก็มีความสุขแล้วนะมันบางครั้งเราก็แปลฉันทะว่าเป็นความรักในการเรียนรู้นะอย่างเช่นเป็นนักเรียนหรือเป็นผู้ปฏิบัติธรรมเนี่ยฉันทะก็คือว่าแค่ได้มาเข้ารีทรีตได้เข้ามานั่งก็พอใจแล้วมีความสุขแล้วที่เราได้ทำเหตุได้ภาวนาสงบหรือไม่สงบอันนี้ไม่ใช่เป็นสิ่งที่ตั้งของฉันทะนะเพราะถ้าสมมติเราอยากได้ความสงบกลายเป็นตัณหาไปเราก็บอกว่ามาปฏิบัติธรรมเที่ยวนี้ไม่ได้อะไรเลยซึ่งหมายความว่าไม่สงบแต่จริงๆแล้วมันไม่ใช่ว่ามันไม่ได้อะไรมันได้เรียนรู้อะไรนะนะในขณะที่จิตของเราไม่สงบถ้าเรามีฉันทะในการสังเกตสังเกตในการศึกษาเราก็จะได้เรียนรู้ว่าให้เราได้อะไรนะจากการทำงานนั้นๆเมื่อกี้นี้ท่านอาจารย์พูดถึงเรื่องที่บอกว่าเราเป็นนักหนังสือพิมพ์จะต้องมีนักหนังสือพิมพ์คนหนึ่งที่มาสัมภาษณ์ท่านอาจารย์บอกว่าเขาเป็นนักหนังสือพิมพ์เขาต้องมีอารมณ์โกรธนะเพราะว่าโกรธแล้วนึกจะเขียนหนังสืออะไรได้ดีนะพวกศิลปินทั้งหลายจะเป็นอย่างเงี้ยนะต้องมีอารมณ์นะคือถ้าไม่มีอารมณ์แล้วเหมือนกับทำงานนะได้ไม่ดีนะท่านอาจารย์ยกตัวอย่างกวีอังกฤษคนหนึ่งที่ เขาก็เป็นคนใช้ชีวิตแบบศิลปินที่ปาร์ตี้นะทำทุกสิ่งทุกอย่างนะแต่ว่าเขาเขียนบทกวีมีสีสันดีเหลือเกินนะเพื่อนๆ เขาก็พยายามชักจูงเขาให้ไม่ทำใช้ชีวิตแบบเหลวแหลกแบบนั้นนะพอตอนหลังแล้วเนี่ยนะเขาก็ลดการใช้ชีวิตแบบปาร์ตี้หรือว่าเหลวแหลกมากขึ้นแต่ปรากฏว่าบทกวีเขาไม่ดีเท่าเดิมแล้วบอกว่าเอ๊ะอย่างนี้เนี่ยนะเราเหมือนกับชีวิตในด้านศิลธรรมดีขึ้นแต่ว่าพวกศิลปะมันลดลงหรือเปล่านะหรือว่านักหนังสือพิมพ์ที่บอกเมื่อกี้นี้ว่าแล้วพอไม่โกรธแล้วเนี่ยเหมือนกับเขียนอะไรได้ไม่ดีเพราะฉะนั้นจำเป็นต้องโกรธนะมีเหตุผลว่าไม่งั้นเนี่ยงานมันก็จะออกไม่ดีนะข้อแย้งของอาตมาคือว่าถ้ามีฉันทะเนี่ยมันสามารถจะเปลี่ยนแรงจูงใจนะจากความโกรธไปเป็นอย่างอื่นได้นะเพราะว่าถ้าจะบอกว่าเป็นบทกวีแล้วก็มีกวีหลายท่านเลยที่เขียนบทกวีที่ลึกซึ้งโดยที่ไม่จำเป็นจะต้องใช้แรงจูงใจจากชีวิตที่เป็นปาร์ตี้ก็ได้อย่างเช่นที่ภาษาอังกฤษก็มี Mary Oliver ที่เขียนบทกวีที่เกี่ยวกับธรรมชาติก็ทำให้เกิดความรู้สึกซาบซึ้งหรือเข้าใจในเรื่องชีวิตได้ดีเหมือนกันโดยไม่จำเป็นจะต้องใช้ชีวิตแบบนั้นก็ได้นะหรือนักหนังสือพิมพ์หลายคนนะที่เปลี่ยนจากการกระตุ้นด้วยความโกรธความไม่พอใจนะแต่เป็นฉันทะคือสิ่งที่เราอยากจะให้คนอ่านเนี่ยได้อะไรได้ประโยชน์อะไรจากสิ่งที่เราเขียนนะเกิดความพอใจยินดีในการที่จะค้นคว้าข้อมูลหรือเรียบเรียงสิ่งที่ตัวเองเขียนเพื่อจะสื่อสารกับคนอื่นให้ได้ดีที่สุดแต่มาก็แย้งว่าตรงกันข้ามเลยถ้ามีฉันทะเนี่ยจะมีความสุขกับการทำงานแล้วก็งานก็จะออกมาได้ดีด้วย
Any other questions? Isaac, wait for the microphone.
As radiance in the heart has so many benefits, both for the individual and the people around about them and society, and it's been known about for so long, why isn't it better known about in the general public? And how could we increase the knowledge of the benefit be created for the world at large?
Good question. When you say radiance in the heart, you mean that quality of...So inner brightness.
Yes.
Well, it's a strange thing, but people tend to focus upon external, say qualities or external things that they bring, say positivity into other people's lives by the things they say or the things that they wear or say the words they create or the music and such like, but just the sheer simple brightness of the mind is something that gets overlooked because it doesn't really have a substance. It's not so tangible. I think that when people meet someone who has a quality of a brightness, a radiance, they know, oh, that's different. That's special.But it's much easier to be able to buy some bright colored clothes, or to buy a piece of music that makes people feel cheerful. And it doesn't demand so much in terms of how you would bring about cultivating that inner brightness yourself. It's much easier just to buy something or to listen to something. That's much more tangible.So I think both of those things, because we go for more accessible substitutes rather than going for, say, an inner quality as a way of our society. It's an outward-looking world more and more. Even in Asia, it's much more of an outward-looking society. It looks towards things and external objects say features of the world around us, the buildings we have, or the gardens we have, or the clothes we wear, or the way we present ourselves in an external way. So those inner qualities are not something that is much spoken about. You know, in Western education, I don't know how much it is in Thailand, but in Western education, it's almost all the emphasis is on what you learn, your knowledge in languages, in literature, in science, in mathematics, and your ability to perform at those subjects. Your quality as a human being is kind of secondary to that. There's a few Buddhist schools here in Thailand, where they like Panyaden School in Chiang Mai and Panyapadip and Bak Chong, Siam Samtrai School in Bangkok, Tor Si School in Bangkok, where there's a very conscious addressing of those inner qualities and creating the causes for a pure heart, for the causes of that kind of brightness of mind in meditation and in attitude. But there's only really those small number of schools that put that on the curriculum, let alone give it a central feature. Like at Panyaden School, they have the 12 wise habits. They were helped by Ajahn Jayasaro in kind of putting those together, like a 10 parameters plus a few extra. But in the West, the concept that you can do something with your mind to make yourself happier, to make your heart more free and more radiant, as you can say, that's a whole new concept. That belongs in the church. It's not part of education. If there's anything, if it's talked about at all, it's talked about in terms of religion, and it's also talked about in terms of getting it from outside, from Jesus or Mary or some external source. So in the West, the concept of being able to change your mind to be, say, radically different is a whole new idea. It's a whole sort of recent introduction. And so it's one of the reasons why there's a lot of enthusiasm about mindfulness now. In the Western world, in the schools, in the education, in the business world, even in the military, in the criminal justice system, because people are seeing that even though you can have a lot of knowledge or a lot of, say, technical abilities, you can still be really unhappy and really confused and insecure. So I particularly feel that the Brahmaviharas, in terms of developing that inner brightness, the development of metta, karuna, mudita, upeka, those four sublime states, they are part of our system of Buddhist practice and training that can very directly support that. But it's not that common that a school or a university or a business will have a special time put aside for the kindness program, or the conscious cultivation of compassion or sympathetic joy. That's something that's sort of a weird idea off of the edges. So part of the efforts that we have in our monasteries is to make those resources more available, to help people to bring about those inner changes. Because not only can we change our minds rather than just adding information into them, but more and more people see that's the most important thing to do. So we have, 70, 80 people here on this retreat gathered together. Ajahn Ju, when he teaches retreats, he has 100 people or so whenever he's taught here before. Every retreat at Amaravati has a waiting list, so it's there's a hunger that's growing, for that those inner qualities to be developed. And so it's we do our best to try and keep pace with that hunger, to feed it. Any thoughts, Sachin?
การศึกษาสมัยใหม่เขาจะแยกชีวิตกับสังคมกับความเป็นมนุษย์ออกไปจากการศึกษาสิ่งที่คนเรียนไปส่วนใหญ่ก็คือมุ่งเน้นเรื่องการแสวงหาวัตถุไม่ค่อยเน้นเรื่องของความมีจิตใจที่ดีมีการแข่งขันการแข่งขันสูงพอมีการแข่งขันสูงชีวิตก็จะมีความทุกข์เยอะมีความทุกข์เยอะแล้วก็แสวงหาไปข้างนอกมากขึ้นเรื่อยๆแต่ว่าการศึกษาแบบพุทธศาสนาเนี่ยเน้นมาที่ความรู้สึกทางจิตความรู้สึกทางใจพัฒนาไปจากภายในบางทีพวกเรามองไม่เห็นเราก็มองเห็นแต่ว่าเราได้อะไรมาเราหามาได้เยอะหาได้เยอะมีความสุขเยอะความคิดของคนส่วนใหญ่ก็จะเป็นอย่างนั้นแต่บางทีเราลืมไปว่าสิ่งที่เราได้มามันทำลายความสามารถในการมีความสุขของพวกเราบางทีเราลืมมองตรงนั้นหาได้เยอะแต่ว่าแทนที่จะมีความสุขเพิ่มขึ้นเรากับความสุขมันหายไปเพราะว่าคุณภาพคุณสมบัติของความสามารถในการที่สร้างความสุขความสามารถในการมีความสุขมันหายไปเหมือนกับเราได้ของมาหนึ่งแล้วก็ลบไปหนึ่งหนึ่งลบหนึ่งไปเรื่อยได้ของมาแทนที่จะมีความสุขเราความสามารถในการมีความสุขของเราหายไปมันก็หายไปหนึ่งได้มาหนึ่งลบไปหนึ่งก็เหลือศูนย์อยู่ล่ำไปแต่ถ้าคนเราสามารถพัฒนามีโอกาสหาสิ่งข้างนอกได้หาความรู้ด้านนอกได้มาแล้วเราก็มีความสุขไปด้วยพวกเรามีข้าวของทรัพย์สมบัติมีบ้านมีรถมีครอบครัวสิ่งที่เห็นได้ชัดๆก็คือถ้าหากเรามีครอบครัวมีคนเดียวมีสามีคนเดียวมีภรรยาคนเดียวความสุขมันก็คือมันมีความสุขสมบูรณ์อยู่แล้วแต่ถ้าหากว่าไปหาอะไรมาเพิ่มให้มันมีสองคนความสุขเริ่มหายไปบางทีคนเข้าใจว่าจำนวนที่ได้มาเยอะๆจะทำให้ดีเหมือนการศึกษาเนี่ยการศึกษาข้างนอกมีความรู้เยอะๆมีความสามารถเยอะๆเอาจริงๆแล้วบางทีแก้ปัญหาตัวเองไม่ได้ภาษาโบราณภาษาไทยโบราณท่านก็บอกว่ารู้มากยากนานรู้มากยากนานรู้เยอะเกินไปแต่แก้ปัญหาตัวเองไม่ได
้ So also it's interesting how you know people look for that kind of inner charge that inner kind of strength or brightness through things that they see like a beautiful building or a beautiful garden orMusic or food, they go, wow, this is so good. Or even things that are frightening, like scary movie, extreme sports like bungee jumping, like bouncing off a bridge, you know, 100 feet over the edge. Even though we think, well, I like music, or I like food, or I like beautiful gardens, or I like to look at these beautiful things, we don't actually like the thing. We like what happens within us when we experience that thing. So we don't actually like bungee jumping. We like that. Maybe there aren't any bungee jumpers here. I just taught a retreat in India, where it's the capital of paragliding in Asia.A couple of the retreatants at the end of the retreat went up in these parachutes, jumping off the hill and flying over the retreat center. One of them was 84 years old. She was the oldest person on the retreat. She went flying afterwards. So we don't love the music. We love the place the music takes us to. That's what it's not the food that we like, it's like that sense of, oh, yes! It's that yes that we like. And whether it's through looking at beautiful people, beautiful food, or whether it's getting frightened or getting angry, you know, going to a sports game or a boxing match and getting stirred up by your team winning or your team being beaten. People, they like that state of concentration and that charge of yes! And they feel, like going back to the question about passion, feeling really alive. But it's not the boxing or the music or the food or the person or that we really love. What we love is our mind. We love what happens in our mind when those particular conditions are there. So it's a kind of poor substitute. So with meditation and the development of wholesome qualities, so concentration and then the Brahmaviharas that bring that kind of inner brightness, inner sort of charge, what we're doing is we're finding that the source for that same kind of radiance, the same kind of energy within our own heart. We don't have to have anybody around. We don't have to be inspired by a Dhamma talk. Because, you know, even though I'm in the role of Dhamma teaching at the moment, oh, this is so great, this is so wonderful, yes! It's still the same thing. You don't really love the Ajahn, you love what happens in you when you hear the Ajahn talking, I would say. Yeah, so that, because every one of us, I can't read people's minds, but I can guarantee every single one of us has had the experience of being with something that is usually really satisfying, that we like a scary movie, or a delicious food, or a beautiful person that we're with, or even some beloved member of our family. And even though that the usual conditions are there, what we feel inside is, yeah, this doesn't help. My mind is so filled with my business worries, I can't enjoy the food. Yeah, it's just another movie. Oh, okay, it's a beautiful place, but, you know, so what? It's just another beautiful place. So, even though the sensory conditions are there, the chemistry doesn't work within us. So, the power of bhavana, meditation, and the development of wholesome qualities is that you learn how to access those qualities within your own heart, and you don't need particular external conditions to support that. That you can, if you're really skilled, you know, the great enlightened ones, regardless of conditions, they are totally sabai. They're having a great old time, even if things are really uncomfortable or difficult. They're fine. Like I remember when Lumpur Cha was really ill and had his stroke and was really compromised in his health. And the people around, oh, Lumpur, you're so unwell, it's so difficult for you. And he said, don't worry about me, worry about yourself. You know, I'm fine. So anyway, another question. One at the back there, yeah. Please use the microphone so everyone can hear.
Very easy question. My question is how and why you become interested in Buddhism and eventually become a monk, and how was your family received?
Well, I'm not very good at short answers. But essentially, I became a Buddhist monk because I wanted to be happy. It's a short answer. And I tried a lot of other things, you know, like I was saying, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. That didn't work. I was quite successful as a student. So I took all my public exams when I was quite young. So I had qualified for university when I was 16. But couldn't actually go to university till I was 18. I had the top marks as a science student in my school. I was a county athlete. So I scored a lot of points. But and so I'd done quite a bit of winning and succeeding, and I was good at things. But then you could see that just winning and succeeding and being clever didn't make you happy. So I went to universities and studied psychology and physiology, thinking, well, I need to understand this mind, because I began to notice, just like I was saying, you can be in a perfect situation with lovely people, beautiful place, everything is just like in a picture book, perfect, and you can still be completely miserable. And so I thought, well, what's the point of trying to get all this stuff if even when you've won all the prizes, you got the big house, you got the beautiful partner who adores you, and yet you can still feel meh. Why make all that effort to get this stuff, or these positions, these roles, if everything depends on the mind? So that was, by the time I got to be about 19 or 20, that was really clear to me, and it was also really clear that academic psychology was not going to answer the questions. That I don't want to be disrespectful to my teachers in the university, but I could see they were not particularly happy people. They knew more about psychologists and their books and their experiments, but they in themselves were not. I didn't see anyone in my teachers. I thought, wow, I'd really like to be her. I'd like to be like him. Just wasn't that way. But what I did find was that when I read various spiritual books, it was the words of various spiritual teachers. I'm not Buddhist. I hadn't even read any Buddhist books. But it was like from Indian gurus or from China, like Chuang Tzu, Lao Tzu. The words would sort of jump off the page and say, oh, that this person understood. This person saw life in a true and a real way. So by the time I finished university, that was the only thing that was interesting to me, was spiritual development. And so even though I had, again, a lot of opportunities, my godfather was a partner of De Beers Diamond Corporation. So I had an open door at De Beers. Any of you who know about diamonds? In those days, De Beers controlled 9 out of every 10 diamonds in the world. So that was an opening. And I could have gone on in academia and different things. But none of it was at all interesting. The only thing that was interesting was spiritual development. And when I read those books or saw those words of the great sort of great masters, and it kind of didn't matter what the language was, whether it was in terms of Taoism or Hinduism or Islam, or it didn't matter. It was like, okay, that person understands. So whatever he did to get to that place, I'll do it. I don't care what it takes. If I have to go live in a cave for 40 years, fine, I'll do it. I want to be where he is to say those words. I want to be in that place to understand life in that way. So I finished my degree, passed my degree, and then left England on a one-way ticket to wander around Southeast Asia. As I said, I had no particular connection with Buddhism. I'd never even read a Buddhist book at that point. But I found myself, I had a free ticket to Malaysia, to KL, so I went down into Indonesia, back up into Thailand, and then finally when I got to Phuket, I was living on a beach in Phuket, the last undeveloped beach then, in Phuket, and it was paradise, beautiful warm seas and palm trees and beautiful people around, and I was completely miserable. Like living in paradise and totally unhappy. This is ridiculous. It's absolutely perfect. It's just like in the adverts. But I'm miserable. I'm unhappy. And so I realized, well, I didn't come to Asia just to hang out with other white middle-class hippie tourists. I came to Asia to try and sort of enter into Asian society, Asian religion. So I decided to leave the beach behind. And I ended up in Ubon because there was a man who had worked in the Ubon refugee camp, who was recovering from an operation. He was spending a few weeks getting over surgery for, he had malaria, had his spleen taken out. So he said, oh, there's this town up in the northeast, I know some people there in Ubon, you could go visit them. I said, yes. He said, there's nobody speaks any English, there's no beach, there's no mountains, there's no tourists ever go there. And I thought, great. So I just got on the train up to Ubon, and then I went to visit this this house where a number of the doctors lived for this refugee camp. And so they let me stay for a night, and then I was asking them about other places to visit, and they said, oh, there's this monastery of Farang monks a few miles away. We were just taking them Christmas presents. So I thought, okay, I'll go stay there for a few days. So that was my introduction to Buddhism, was walking into Wat Pa Nanachat as a, you know, straight off the beach. Still had sand in my hair, shell in my ear. And so I didn't know the fact I didn't know anything about Buddhism was an advantage, because I didn't have any preconceptions. I'd never heard of Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Mahabur, Ajahn Tate. I'd never heard of Mahanikaya, Dhammayut. Never even heard of Mahayana Theravada. It's just, you know, I showed up, and then this is the way of life that they had, the kind of forest monk's way of life. And it was exactly what I was looking for. And so I thought, I'll stay until I find out that the Buddha was wrong. So I kind of rigged it. Because I had a suspicion that I wasn't going to find out that the Buddha was wrong. And I was 21 years old at that time. That was 1978. So, but I realized that my I was going to be staying there a long time. I had the feeling. So I tried to break it to my family gently, but it didn't do much good. I'm the youngest child, the only son. And they were imagining I was going to sort of go around the world and, as we say, sow a few wild oats, and then come back and marry a nice girl, get a straight job, and have little curly-haired children with good English accents and proper table manners who go to the right schools and do well in class. You know? And so I tried to break it to them gently in the kind of as casual and a way as possible. But I also never said, I'm only doing this for a short time and then I'll carry on with my journey. I knew I didn't want to make them hope. I said, I'm trying this for now, and we'll see what happens. So I never, very consciously, didn't feed their hopes that I would see I would wake up and realize this was all totally stupid, and leave it behind. So they were unhappy, disappointed. But also, one of the things that's different in the West and in Thailand, some of you. You know, you're 50, 60, maybe 70 years old, and you're still doing what your parents want you to do, right? I've had many conversations with quite a few of you, so I know that's true. That even if you're an independent adult, but still, mum wants me to do this, dad wants me to do that. It's like, you know, you're the head of a kind of multi-billion baht corporation, and still, well, if dad wants it, yeah, I have to. So in the West, it's like my parents were, well, you're 21, you can make your own decisions. It's up to you. We don't like it, but it's your choice. That's it. So that's a blessing. So even though it was a wrench for them, they stuck to that. They never objected. They didn't like it, but they never made a fuss or tried to stop me. So that was... something I greatly appreciated. After about...
Are they happy now?
They're both dead now. So whether they're happy or not, it's up to them. No, I'm the youngest child of older parents. So if my father was alive now, he would be just 108 years old. And if my my mother was alive, she would be... 98. So they've long since passed away. But it took about 15 years. And so when I got to be in my sort of mid to late 30s, My two older sisters, neither of them were married. Both of them were career women. I was a Buddhist monk. And so there was absolutely no hope of any grandchildren. And all of their kind of expectations of what the family would do had been completely lost. And so they decided, okay, well, just forget all of that. Look and see what the children are doing and have respect for that. And to see, okay, well, look at them, just look at their lives. Well, they're all sort of contented with their own worlds and they have satisfaction with what they're doing. So, okay. So there was some kind of a shift in the whole view. So, and when it was only when there was a crisis in the family, when someone had died or there was some kind of big problem, then Buddhism and meditation would make sense for about 3 days. And then after 3 days, then the crisis would pass, and then they'd be back to discussing, you know, what do you want for lunch tomorrow, where they're going to go on their next holidays, revisiting family memories, you know, business as usual. But for 3 days, then the religious questions would become meaningful. But that was okay. As my mother put it, I care about you because you're my son, not because you're a monk. So don't give me that monk stuff. Okay, fair enough. It's true. I can't. If you can.
Did Christianity not give you the answer for happiness?
No. Well, the approach to Christianity, I understand Christianity much better now that I'm a Buddhist monk. So when I was a child, the whole thing was put forward as something that you're supposed to believe. So when I was about 7, all the schools I went to, they had a Christian service, Church of England service, at the beginning of the school day, every day. And at one point, when I was 7, we had to learn what's called the Apostles' Creed. I believe in God the Father, creator of heaven and earth, so forth. And so the teacher, who was a Church of England vicar, was having us learn this. And so we got to the first line, and I stuck my hand up. Because I was that kind of a child, you know, I was always asking, ready to ask questions. And I said, "Sir, if you don't believe in God, should you say the words and be lying, or should you not say the words?" And he just said, "Don't be cheeky, boy." I thought it was a fairly fair question. You know, if you're saying the words, "I believe in God the Father, creator of heaven and earth," if you don't believe in God, if you're saying the words, you're lying. So what's the right thing to do? Should you say the words and lie, or should you not say the words? Seemed reasonable to my 7-year-old brain. And he just said, "Don't be cheeky." And so I thought, that's stupid. That's ridiculous. And so And then also, when you had teachings from the Bible, like say, you know, "Ask and it will be given unto you." Well, you know, I say, "Well, I want a fire engine for Christmas," and I didn't get a fire engine. So, well, they said, if you ask, it'll be given. You know, like when you're even younger, you're kind of maybe 5 years old, you say, "Ask and it will be given unto you," and it's a kind of esoteric Dhamma teaching. But it's being taught to young children. You say, "Ask and it'll be given to you." Well, I asked and I didn't get it. It's a lie. It's false. What's this about? So the Bible didn't make sense to me until I started the New Testament. Didn't make sense to me in particular until I was already a Buddhist monk, and then I could understand a bit more. It's like Jesus is more like a kind of Zen master. But it's like taking the words of a Zen master and then getting little children to recite them. It's like, well, no wonder. I couldn't make sense of it. Buddhism was much more helpful to me because I have a kind of mind that doesn't like to believe. I need to have things proved. And so when I came across Buddha Dhamma at Banana Chat, and you're encouraged not to believe. Oh, great! I like this. Yeah, but to test it out and see for yourself, that made perfect sense, and that the whole approach was so different, and so that I have quite good friends who are Christians, you know, mostly Christian monks and nuns, and I've co-led events with Christian teachers, and so now I feel I have a much better understanding of that world, but only because of having a background of Buddhist meditation. So I can happily respect people who have a life as committed Christians, but the whole way of thinking around belief and say taking a particular ideology to be absolutely true, that just never worked for me. You know, forget when I was living in America, you get stopped on the street sometimes by Jehovah's Witnesses, and they say, "We want to bring you the good. We want to give you the good news about God." And I would say something like, "What do you mean by the word God?" And they just kind of wouldn't know what to say, and then they walk off. Sometimes you have a longer conversation, but that kind of "this is true and everything else is wrong," that never, my mind just would never accept that. So when coming across the prasut in the sutta teachings, the Buddha using that phrase as a way of describing the wrong approach, that only this is true, everything else is wrong, that's necessarily inaccurate. That can't be matching the reality of things. So I thought, yes. Yes. Wait for the microphone.
Maybe this question I'm going to ask might have to be answered, because it might take a long time to explain what I'd like to know about what happened when I was a novice monk up at Wat Banana Chat in 1984. At that time, I was told, and I didn't see these monks, but I was told there was a couple of monks there who actually meditated for days and days, even weeks. So my question is, what were they trying to achieve by meditating for such a long period?
When you say they were meditating for days or weeks, you mean like in a continuous state of absorption without moving?
Yes. They even told me they didn't eat.
Yeah, well, if they're not moving, then...
Yes.
Yeah. So, whether it was sort of true in that instance, I certainly know of very accurate reports of other Buddhist meditators being able to do that. It's a particular level of concentration that the mind can be trained to go into, what are called the arupa jhana, or the formless absorptions, and so that the mind is say brought to an extremely acute state of concentration. Exactly why someone chooses to do that, that's up to them. You know? There might be a variety of different reasons. A lot of it can be to do with just sharpening the mind's ability to focus, but it's that kind of degree of concentration is something that over time, and also the Buddha described that himself, that he could sit without moving for 7 days and seven nights and enjoy more bliss than even the most wealthy monarch. Like he said, "I can sit without moving for 7 days and seven nights and I have far more pleasure than King Bimbisara in his palace with all of his kind of decorations and concubines and beautiful food." So exactly what someone's choosing to do with those states of mind is going to depend on their own intention. Because the ability to concentrate doesn't isn't necessarily unified with wisdom. One of the most prominent disciples of Venerable Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Tate, in his autobiography, My Life as a Buddhist Monk, he describes how he lived in Phuket, in a monastery down there, and during those years, he developed a lot of skill with these states of deep absorption. But he got so good at it that he couldn't actually lower his concentration. And he, in his autobiography, he describes how it took him years to train himself to not do that. Because kind of as soon as he'd sit down and close his eyes, he'd find himself completely absorbed. And the advice from Lungpu Mun was, you know, yeah, those are wholesome states and they're enjoyable, but they're not liberating. And if you really want to complete your practice and reach full enlightenment, you need to lower the level of concentration to be just aware, to be able to be aware of the arising and passing of the five khandhas. So you need to kind of ramp down. So that ability of his actually became an obstruction. But I do know of various reports of both in ancient times or in modern times. So one of the incidents here in Thailand, a Chinese master, Master Xu Yun, walked from China to Bangkok, and I forget which monastery in Bangkok it was, but he sat for 9 days in the courtyard in this monastery. So of course that got people's attention, so by the time he opened his eyes 9 days later, there was all kinds of flowers and offerings around him. He wasn't doing it to show off, but he was it certainly got people's attention. And that time, it was about 1908, so about 110 years ago, it certainly got people's attention, and I think the interest in Buddhism from China was sort of elevated at that point. There's also a laywoman, an Indian laywoman who studied in Burma for a long time, a woman called Deepama. And she also had very, very profound abilities to concentrate. And she, because also one of the things with that kind of practice is that you can determine how long you want to be in that state for. And so she had, you know, read this in the suttas, and her own teachers had talked about this. So she thought, well, let's do an experiment. So, okay, I'll go into absorption and I'll say, okay, let's say I'm going to come out of this absorption in 2 days, yeah, and 2 days and 10 minutes and 38 seconds. Let's see how accurate this thing is. And so she worked out, okay, in 2 days, 10 minutes and 38 seconds, it'll be that time. So she sat down with a clock in front of her. And according to her own story, which one would understand to be reliable, was that when she opened her eyes, it was exactly that time. So she said, oh, it works, right. Interesting. And so she was not someone who was trying to show off or present herself. She was an extremely humble person. And so even though people were kind of impressed with her abilities those kind of things, she'd say, why do you bother me with this, talking about all this stupid stuff? What's more important is you ending greed, hatred, and delusion. So she was very, very sort of direct in that way. Apparently, she could bake a potato in her hand. And so apparently, when someone was very impressed with that, she said, I can make it taste like chocolate if you like. So, but there's a book of her life story called Knee Deep in Grace, which describes some more important aspects of her life and teaching. But so I don't have a doubt that because of sort of close personal accounts that there are people who can do that. But also sometimes people have those abilities and they do just go into absorption and sit in a public place in order to show off. But there was another of Ajahn Chah's disciples who used to do that. And he would say, well, it was just a convenient place to sit. Or it's like, yeah, right. You know. And sitting himself down in a kind of a marketplace or somewhere, and Lumpur Cha used to give him quite a bad time because. because he could see, well, yes, yeah, he's a good meditator, but he's really quite fond of the idea that he's a good meditator. He's a bit too happy about that, a bit too glad to be known for those abilities. Where someone like Dipamar or Master Shu Yun, they would say, okay, you know, this is part of it, but this is not the important thing. So that makes you say more likely to trust what they've got to say and why they would say it. Okay, the hour has gone by.
Could I have one question, please? I found your selection of your quotation from the Tipitaka very unusual. And very unusual to come from the forest monastery. What is the role of Tipitaka for the forest monastery and for us meditators?
That's a good question. I was talking about this with some of the other monks just yesterday. The first 15 years or so of my life in the forest monasteries was mostly hearing Dhamma teachings of Lumpo Cha, Lumpo Sumedho, and they very rarely quote much of the sutta. And then when I was living with Ajahn Pasanno, and we were starting a Bhayagiri monastery together, he had studied a lot more of the suttas, and then he would quote them in his Dhamma talks, so he would be able to bring up particular sutta passages in our conversations. So over and over again, I thought, oh, that's useful. Oh, I must remember that. Or, oh, I should take a note of where that comes from. And then we were encouraged to write a book, a collection of teachings on Nibbana and the Paramattha Satcha. So took 10 years to put together this book called The Island, the Buddha's teachings on Nibbana. So then that, by the time that 10 years had gone by, I was really quite familiar with a lot of the sutta teachings, things that we'd used in the book. I think in the forest tradition, there's quite an emphasis on trusting the words of your teacher and, you know, trusting your own insight. And because there's been a particular kind of almost anti-scholastic ethic within the forest tradition, because which is not the same as in Burma or in Sri Lanka, but there's a 100 years or so ago, 140 years ago, there was a bit of a division, so that the meditators almost became sort of one camp, and then the scholars became a different camp. So it became almost like an anti-scholarship element within the forest tradition. So I think one of the reasons why amongst Westerners there's more of that, both myself drawing upon suttas and people like Ajahn Pasno and other Ajahns in the West, is because we didn't grow up hearing the stories of the Buddha's life. We weren't around the ceremonies where those words are being recited. So it wasn't in our culture. So when I went to Wat Bapong, the standard was, you know, close the books and don't read a book for 5 years, just read your own jitta. That was the teacher's encouragement. Just read your own jitta. So, okay, put the books away. But then when we came to the West, we found that we were incredibly ignorant of basic Buddhist teachings. Yeah. It was not uncommon for a monk not to be able to name all eight factors of the Eightfold Path. You know. Really? Samaditi. What's the second? Sang something. Sankapo, that's right. So I feel particularly for Westerners, it's because we need to have that sort of the access to the suttas to inform the teachings. That your own insight is one thing, but we haven't grown up with that culture of Buddhist teachings and Buddhist principles all around us. We've had more of the Judeo-Christian skeptical materialist environment. So in order to have the teachings be well informed by skillful principles, then certainly making a study of the suttas and memorizing particular suttas and using suttas in the teachings, it has become sort of more and more a part of our lives. Also studying Pali, which in the past, you know, Lumpur Cha would kind of tolerate monks who wanted to do the Pariyatti. You were allowed to, but it wasn't particularly encouraged. So I feel that particularly for helping Buddha Dhamma to be a force around the world, that the studying the suttas and getting familiar, particularly with certain key teachings. I was saying, you know, when, even though I quote something and I say, oh, it's Sutta 116 from Book 35 of the Samyutta Nikaya, I know that's correct. But I couldn't tell you what Sutta 117 is, or 120. I know that one, but I don't necessarily know all the ones around it. I think getting familiar with a body of key teachings and really knowing them well is something that's important. And amongst Buddhist groups in the West, there's quite a lot that really want to have the Sutta teachings sort of explained and introduced to them. So it's all around the world, like in Britain, in Europe, in the USA, Australia, you get Dhamma study groups that want to go through the Sutta and to get familiar. Also because the language of the Suttas, even in English, is quite stylized. The repetitions and the phrasing is odd to the eye, so people need a kind of explanation and commentary. And so it's really up to the Sangha to get to be able to pick up that kind of interpreting role, so it can make the suttas come alive for people. Okay. So that's enough for today. Thank you for your good questions.